Protesters in Chicago, they are demanding justice for Adam Toledo, a 13-year-old Latino who was shot and killed by a police officer in the city last month. The case gained national attention after the Chicago Police Department released body camera footage showing Toledo had his hands up before he was shot and killed. The video contradicted a statement previously put out by a prosecutor with the Cook County State Attorney's Office who claimed that the 13-year-old had been holding a gun when he was shot. Here's the Toledo family attorney, Adina Weiss-Ortiz, speaking with reporters last week.
All I know is that the officer is trained to not shoot an unarmed individual. Not shoot an unarmed child. If he asked him to toss it and show his hands and the kid complies, then he shouldn't be shot.
Toledo's killing underscores the reality of police violence against Latinos in the United States. According to research by the Washington Post from 2015 to 2020, Latinos were the second highest demographic killed by police after Black Americans. I'm Tanzina Vega, and whether Adam Toledo's killing has the potential to galvanize Latinos in Chicago around issues of police brutality is where we start today on The Takeaway. Joining me now is Eduardo Portillos, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. Eddie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I want to ask you, what was your initial reaction to seeing the video of the killing of Adam Toledo, especially as someone who has studied police violence?
You know, I think like a lot of people, and again, I have to extend my condolences to the family. It wasn't a surprise. I had seen these situations before, but I think what is the most surprising and what struck me in this case is that there was a video. We don't often have these videos. And so that's an important piece to this story. But it wasn't surprising because we see it happening again and again in barrio communities throughout the Southwest in the United States, where young people like Adam, who should just have a friendly, should have an interaction with the police that shouldn't end in their death. And unfortunately, in this situation, it has, and it has been occurring time and time again.
Mayor Lightfoot has responded to the killings, but when you listen to what she has to say, is that what we usually hear from people in charge?
You know, we hear from people in charge that often this doesn't have to do with race, that we have to respect the process. We have to let the investigation happen. You know, we have to watch the video carefully. But when this happens again and again, we can understand the frustration and the anger that we see in the community. You know, the police will tell us that this had nothing to do with race. Officers who are involved in this situation, officers who have interactions with kids daily in the community will say that this had nothing to do with race. You know, in some of the research that I've done, I think that it has to do with race more than what we're hearing from the police officers, especially in these neighborhoods like Little Village, a largely traditional Mexican neighborhood where I've done a lot of my research in Arizona, in California. And it's in these neighborhoods where we see these concerns with the police. And so they'll say race doesn't matter, but you know, I think it does in ways that people don't recognize. You know, police officers with the research that I've done would talk about these areas as war zones, as places that should be avoided, as places that I shouldn't walk alone when I was doing my own research in Arizona. And they even offered me protection as I was doing my research there. But, you know, I had been in there, in that community previously, had walked the neighborhoods, had been knocking on the apartments, the same ones they told me not to knock on. And I didn't have that fear that they talked about. So I think that's part of the issue, is we need to recognize, our leaders need to recognize, people in our society need to recognize the way in which race plays out in ways that we often don't recognize. That creates these images of kids that are bad, that we criminalize them, that we should lock them up.
You know, Eddie, we spoke earlier, I spoke to Sergeant Johnny Nunez, who's the founder and president of the Global Alliance of Hispanic Law Enforcement Professionals, among other titles. And he said to me straight out that he said officers don't see color He's a Latino officer. You said a lot of cops will say this has nothing to do with race. What do you assess? I definitely push back on him on that, but I'm just curious about your interpretation of one of the top Latino cops in this country saying that officers don't see color.
And I truly believe that officers think that, right? They're trained to react to the situation. They're trained that they want to go home. They're trained that they want to be safe. They want to take care of the community. They're not trained to talk about how race operates in our society. They will have some bias training, some implicit bias kinds of things that we'll see. But when I talk to officers, they really didn't enjoy those. They tried to avoid those trainings. And so I think, you know,
I could see a rank and file officer trying to avoid that, but this is someone who's really at the top of a lot of his colleagues. So I was somewhat concerned about that rhetoric.
That is concerning, but it's not surprising because this is the view that many police officers have. They really believe that race has nothing to do with any of these shootings. That's how they've been trained. They interact daily with other officers and they don't see race playing out. Whereas, you know, as an outsider coming in, I do see the subtle ways. For example, racial joking was common in the police department that I was studying. And when I would ask officers about it, they would just say, hey, you know what? That's just how we address stress. We see the worst of the worst day in and day out. And so this racial joking is nothing. But we see this again and again, you know, officers with their Facebook, some officers with their Facebook posts and those kinds of things, the racist language that we'll hear sometimes broadcast on the radio frequencies. But and so I see it as race, but officers truly believe that this has nothing to do. So, you know, in this case, a high ranking police official, it's not surprising.
Eddie, let's talk a little bit about how Latino communities are policed in general. You've studied these interactions throughout your career. This took place in a neighborhood like Little Village in Chicago, which is Latino, majority Latino. And as we stated at the top of the segment, Latinos are only second to Black Americans in terms of having these types of interactions with police. So what is the relationship like between Latino communities, particularly if they're poor or working class, and police in this country?
Those are the types of communities like Little Village that I studied time and time again. It started in Arizona with my dissertation research and has continued on to a present study that I'm doing in Fresno with my colleagues. And what you'll see in these communities and in this most recent study that I've carried out, my colleagues and I, in Fresno, California. It's been with a group of youth who will come to the attention of law enforcement, youth who are involved in gangs, youth who are involved in juvenile delinquent activities. And we'll ask them, you know, why is it that you're involved in criminal activities? What is it like to be policed every day? And it's a sense of frustration that I've talked about earlier, a sense of anger because they are constantly stopped. You have some kids who are trying to live a good life. They have college aspirations. Some of them may want to be police officers. They'll have more positive interactions and views of the police. But some of those kids will also have negative interactions with the police just because of the way in which the aggressive policing operates in these communities. So it's proactive, it's looking for criminal activity before it happens. And so the youth would talk about this happening in their lives by being stopped, by being questioned as they were walking through the neighborhood, that it wasn't their experience only, but it was their friends' experiences. And they would talk about these experiences of where the officers would try to egg them on sometimes. They would make fun of them, they would mock them, they would demean them. And the youth would readily recognize, you know what? Yeah, we're not doing things that we should. You know, we were probably, you know, involved in drugs. I might have been drinking alcohol. So they will readily admit that they were doing things that they weren't. But at this age, you know, kids don't always make the right decisions. But it doesn't have to end in their death or in the cases that I've looked at of experiencing police violence.
we should also be clear that it's not always children or young people who are involved in nefarious activities who have negative interactions with the police.
Exactly. It's those good kids in the neighborhood. It's kids like my sons, you know, my nephews, our relatives who are growing up in these communities who are trying to be good kids that have bad experiences with the police. You are exactly right.
Now, here's an interesting tension point, if you will. Despite the disparities in how Black and Latino people are often stopped by the police and in some cases killed by the police, Latinos still say that they have at least some confidence in the police. In a Pew poll from June 2020, 74% of Latinos said they had a great deal or a fair amount of confidence in the ability of a police officer to work on behalf of the public. That's compared to 56% of Black Americans who said they felt the same way. How do we explain that disparity on the fact that there are Latinos who, at least three quarters of the population that Pew surveyed, who said they have some confidence in police, and yet they are the second largest group being affected by these types of negative police interactions?
I think there's a couple ways that we explain this. And I begin first with this notion that Tracy Mears talks about, of a dual frustration. She talked about a dual frustration in African-American communities and where they were frustrated with drugs on the one hand, but they were also frustrated with the treatment that they received by the criminal justice system, the courts, and law enforcement specifically. And so I believe the Latinx community experiences this dual frustration, right? Because they're frustrated with gangs, they're frustrated with drugs, they're frustrated with the violence and the high crime rates in their community.
What I'm wondering, Eddie, is whether or not you see this as a moment. I mean, I'm also thinking about the killings of Sean Monterosa, for example, Antonio Valenzuela, for example, others, names of Latinos who've been killed by police. Is there a moment, is this a moment for Latinos to galvanize around police brutality across the country?
I'm hopeful and that it is, that this is a moment where we finally recognize that these issues are prevalent in the Latinx community. This isn't the first shooting, and you've given a list of a number of people that have been killed from the Latinx community, but that list is long. I can think back when I started doing this research in Arizona, and Julio Valerio in Arizona, his parents called for help, asking for assistance, and he ended up being killed by the police. You know, he had a knife in an alley, and they pepper sprayed him. He raised his hands to his eyes, assuming to wipe away the pepper spray. But the police saw that as he was raising his hand to throw the knife, and they shot him. They shot him multiple times. And so, you know, this isn't new. I mean, I talk about it, and others talk about it as being historical, as being state-sanctioned violence and a form of racialized social control that historically we've seen in the Latinx community. Since the Mexican-American War and the Treaty of Guadalupe, we've seen this again and again in the Southwest. The Texas Rangers and other police officials trying to provide what Miranda calls a double justice. On the one hand, whites receive kind of very prevalent good treatment by the criminal justice system, whereas Latinx don't, and they experience abuses by the criminal justice system. Ed Escobar has talked about this for a number of years. I'm doing research in the 1900s and 1945 with the Latinx community. We saw this in the 1970s with the Chicano movement. So sadly, this isn't new, but there's a very long list. And it's about state-sanctioned violence and racialized social control in the Latinx community.
You mentioned a number of people. I remember the death of Anthony Baez in 1994 in New York City, and that was really another question of asphyxiation and an improper use of a chokehold. I mean, you're right. This is something that has existed for decades. And I'm wondering, you know, one of the other things that Sergeant Nunez, when we spoke to him earlier, said was that, you know, he sort of, you know, said that there really aren't any racial issues here. And he pointed to the NYPD and said how racially diverse our own police corps is here in New York City. And while that may be true, looking back to data, for example, from Stop, Question, and Frisk, still showed that New Yorkers of color, largely Black and Latino New Yorkers, were stopped and frisked at higher rates than whites were. So, I mean, can we clearly say that this is something that's going to, is diversifying the police force actually going to change this?
You know, that's been a question that's been around for a couple of decades, whether diversifying the police department would matter.
Or, Eddie, and before you answer that, I will say, and of course, we know there's also calls to just defund the police and abolish the system entirely.
Exactly. This question about diversifying the police first, you know, there have been attempts, and we've seen this in L.A., right, in Los Angeles, where a large percentage of the officers there are from the Latinx community or part of the Latinx community. But we still see people of color shot and killed by the police, stopped and searched at disproportionate rates. So, you know, I think it matters in where we're pulling these individuals from. At least with my own research, I looked at officer differences by race in terms of how they perceived the community. And those Latinx officers who weren't a part of that community tended to identify the communities in ways that were similar to whites, where they saw it as a war zone, as they saw it as dangerous. But those individuals who have grown up in that community, who had family in that community, who had experiences in that community growing up, they tended to have a more positive outlook. And I think we need more of that. People from the communities to police their own, right? And it's difficult, though. And I've heard this from police departments where they try to recruit, but often they can't recruit young people from those neighborhoods. I think that's partly because of the fear that people have of the police. But I think it's also partly that, you know, people want their kids not to always go to a dangerous career. You know, if you can be an engineer.
Well, Eddie, we've got just one minute left to go. And I'm just thinking, I mean, are calls for defunding the police growing among Latinos? Because there are people who say this system cannot be fixed. It must be abolished entirely. We've got a minute left.
Okay. To address that question, that's tough, right? Because we need police officers. I've seen police officers within my own community respond and be effective. So we need some kind of policing to protect our communities, but we need a better policing than what we have now. So it may be allocating funds in different ways. So we're utilizing more respectful, restorative justice kinds of approaches, rather than always using these aggressive approaches that create distrust within the community. So
Eduardo Portillos is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. Eddie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Another mass shooting, another workplace, another city, another American tragedy. Gun violence has become so pervasive in the United States, and it takes both a physical and emotional toll. I mean, at this point, you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone who hasn't been touched by it in some way, whether directly or through the experience of collective trauma and fear. And often after the news cameras leave the scene, family and friends are left behind to deal with the toll of being a survivor. We're going to turn the mic over to two people who understand this reality better than most.
I'm Sandy Phillips. I am the mother of Jessica Redfield Gowie, who was slaughtered in the Aurora Theater shooting in 2012.
My name is Lonnie Phillips. I'm the stepfather of Jessica Gowie and the husband of Sandy.
Sandy and Lonnie's 24-year-old daughter, Jessie, was one of 12 people killed during the 2012 mass shooting inside of a Century 16 movie theater in Aurora, Colorado. More than 70 other people were injured.
She was vibrant. She was funny. She was smart. She was a wordsmith. She was loving, caring. She was our world.
On the night of the shooting, Sandy says Jessie was being visited by a friend in Texas.
He was there for one more night, and she heard that there was a Batman opening premiere, and knew that he loved Batman. So she got online and tried to get tickets, and they were all sold out. But my daughter was very tenacious. She didn't give up easily. And she scored tickets to the 12:05 showing, which put them into Theater 9 instead of Theater 8.
Theater 9 was where the gunman entered the movie theater and started his rampage. Sandy had been texting with her daughter that night, shortly before the screening. About 30 minutes later, she got a phone call.
My phone rang, and I looked down, and it was the person that she was at the movies with. And I thought, that's weird. You know, why would he be calling me? They're at the movies. And I took the phone call, and I could hear screaming in the background. And he proceeded to tell me there had been a shooting. And I asked if he was okay. And he said, I think I've been shot twice. And I knew immediately that Jesse must be hurt badly because she would be calling me. And I said, where's Jesse? He said, I tried. And I said, is she okay? And he said, I tried. And I said, oh God, Brent, please tell me she's not dead. And started screaming, woke my husband up.
And she was sliding down the wall, screaming, Jesse's dead. And in shock, I went to her and said, you can't possibly know that. And she said, yes, I know that because I just talked to Brent. That moment, I knew that I no longer had a daughter, and I would never have the same wife I had before I went to sleep.
In the immediate aftermath, Sandy said they felt numb and just didn't know where to turn. Nobody in their life had ever been through something like that before. 5 months later, when 26 children and staff were killed at a mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School, the couple decided to travel there from Texas and meet with some of the parents.
I said to my husband, I said, that's exactly what we looked like 5 months ago. And the horror and the disbelief and the shock that were on their faces, that look of not being able to comprehend that your life had been forever altered by gun violence, just spoke to me in such a way that I knew that was what we were meant to do.
Since then, Sandy and Lonnie have been working to support people affected by gun violence.
We formed Survivors Empowered because there was nobody there to help us. And we just decided that maybe we're the people that can help. And at first it was just, you know, we're here to hold your hand, let you cry, tell us about your loved one. And then it took on different layers.
According to Lonnie, they weren't politically active up until the Aurora shooting, and they've even owned guns themselves.
We were oblivious. We were not political animals. We voted on presidential elections and that's about it. We were on with our lives like everybody else. So we know the people that we're trying to reach because they are us. We were them.
Like the people they work with now, Sandy and Lonnie have relied on different tools like trauma-informed therapy and mindfulness to help them navigate both the immediate aftermath of their daughter's death, but also the re-traumatization that follows, including every time there's another mass shooting in the news.
Gun violence is a ripple effect. And what we're seeing happen now is, you know, so many stones have been tossed into this lake that the ripple effect is becoming a tsunami. And you know, sooner or later, it will get fixed because there are so many of us now that have been affected.
But gun control legislation at the federal level has been largely absent since the 1993 Brady Bill. With Joe Biden in the White House and a Democrat-controlled Congress, coupled with dwindling power of the NRA, Sandy and Lonnie say they're hopeful things will change.
The time is now. It's a hashtag that we use. The time is now. We have a small window to get all of these bills that are stacked up on Mitch McConnell's desk over the past 4 years. We have a chance to get those through Congress.
Sandy and Lonnie said they would continue to help those who need their help. According to them, You don't move on from a tragedy like this, you move forward. For anyone listening who might need it, Sandy wanted to offer up this piece of advice.
First, they need to be kind to themselves. There is such an expectation that we're supposed to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and move on. Literally, within the first year, you will have people saying, well, that was a year ago. You need to get over this. And that is the cruelest thing you could ever say to somebody who has lost somebody to gun violence, because you don't get over it and you don't move like your life is okay again. It's never okay again. You just find coping mechanisms. And those coping mechanisms can be either very helpful or very hurtful.
Sandy and Lonnie Phillips are founders of Survivors Empowered. You can learn more about the work they're doing at survivorsempowered.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. It's become a phenomenon unique to the United States, mass shootings whose carnage is impossible to keep track of. This year alone, there have been at least 152 mass shootings. As public spaces from grocery stores to workplaces become increasingly dangerous, we're talking to two folks who's going to help us break down the mental health effects of mass shootings and policy changes that must take place. Ron Acherno is the executive director of the Trauma Resilience Center and professor of psychiatry at UT Health Houston. Ron, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
And Adam Skaggs is chief counsel and policy director for Giffords Law Center. Adam, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Ron, I'm just going to skip the first question I have and just be honest, which probably as a journalist isn't a good idea, but I don't want to leave my house right now. I spent the weekend looking, could not keep track of the number of mass shootings that have taken place. I call this a sickness, and I don't know how else to explain it.
When you look at homicide rates across the industrialized world, you know, what we call quote unquote first world countries, we blow everybody else out of the water in terms of homicide and mass violence. So I think your response is the appropriate one. In terms of disgust, perhaps not in terms of not wanting to leave the house, but we are an extraordinarily violent country for the first world, and no one else is close to us.
Well, so what do you say to? I mean, this is happening. It was happening in schools. It's happening in grocery stores. It's happening at workplaces. Like, I mean, obviously we have to leave the house, but leaving the house has become a situation where you just don't know if you're going to return from quotidian activities.
Well, let me first say that statistically, you are safe in leaving the house. And rationally, it is a thing you can do. And it's when we start changing our behavior based on perception as opposed to reality that it becomes a problem, a functional impairment. So, you know, I just want to put it out there. It's not dangerous to leave your house, although it might be more dangerous here. Overall, it's not dangerous to leave your house. But when you have as many violent events with as much press coverage as we have, the perception that it's extraordinarily dangerous is going to be there. And it probably should be. I mean, we shouldn't accept these things as if they were normal. Unfortunately, the statistic you just gave, and I think we've had six since Friday when you called me to be on the show, six mass shootings sort of makes the normal. And that's what I'm sort of worried about, that this is becoming too commonplace such that those who are not afraid to leave their house don't even think twice about it.
Adam, Are there any demographic or geographical trends in terms of where this type of violence is taking place?
Well, I think the short answer to that is, unfortunately, it's taking place everywhere. When you talk about these mass shootings, you know, we've had more mass shootings than days this year thus far. But I think it's also, when you think about gun violence in this country, it's important to note that the vast majority of deaths don't take place in these mass shootings that get so much media attention. They just take place in day-to-day incidents of violence that often don't get very much coverage. You know, last year we had a pandemic that exerted a devastating toll on public health. We also saw a massive increase in gun violence and in deaths from fatal shootings. So the FBI is still releasing data. It hasn't sort of finalized the 2020 data yet. But we've seen the 50 largest cities in the country, we've seen in almost every single one of them a massive increase, an average of about 35% increase in fatal gun shootings last year. And then, of course, suicide drives a huge amount of this violence. So it's unfortunately something that affects communities of all kinds across this country.
What type of effect does this type of violence or even the perception of this type of violence have on our brains?
Well, you know, when you're exposed to violence in person, if it's directed at you or if it's directed towards someone right next to you, you have a fight or flight response. You get activated. You either need to run away from the situation or deal with the situation. If this happens repeatedly, your brain quite literally starts to burn itself out. You can only sustain such intensity for so long. So a coping response, and your prior guest was straight on. She said, you know, some of these coping responses are very negative. Could be withdrawal, could be substance abuse, some way to numb the things. But the bottom line is you don't just get used to it. Now, getting used to it and getting desensitized to it are two very different things. When you hear it on the news, but you're not experiencing it yourself and you hear it all the time, you get desensitized to it. When you experience it in the family or firsthand, which, as Adam said, then you start to get burned out by it. You start to get anxious. You have problems sleeping. You might have problems with your stomach. You know, different people manifest in different ways. But the anxiety and the depression and the withdrawal are the most common symptoms. And when this happens repeatedly, you don't get used to it. You get more sensitized to it.
Adam, are we seeing more political engagement around this issue because of what we're seeing on media and the fact that, for example, we just had 6 mass shootings in a couple of days?
Well, look, I think the public has made clear, public opinion is clear that we've had enough of this. We want action. We want our leaders, whether in Congress or at the state or local level, to take action to do something about this. You know, gun violence is only increasing and the status quo is unacceptable. And I think we've seen the public make very clear they want to see action.
Adam, President Biden announced some executive actions to address gun violence. What do we know so far?
Well, I think the fact that the president and the Biden-Harris administration has acted on this issue within the first 100 days is a promising sign. I think it's a good start. And I think some of the actions that they have announced are going to be important. They're an important first step. Particularly, they've announced they're going to reassess and promote a rule that will address how to deal with so-called ghost guns. These are do-it-yourself sort of homemade guns that people can buy without background checks. And that's a really serious threat to public safety. They've announced that they're going to address the type of weapon that was used in the shooting in Boulder. This is effectively a short-barreled assault weapon, and they're going to address that. But ultimately, we need Congress to act. You know, the House of Representatives has already passed 2 really important pieces of gun legislation this year, extending background checks to make sure that anytime somebody buys a gun, they pass a background check, and that the FBI has time to complete the background check so that nobody actually acquires a gun while the background check is still ongoing. So those are really important pieces of legislation. They are now in the Senate, and obviously there are some political challenges there. But the fact that the president and the administration have already announced they're going to do what they can do via executive action, I think is a very important sign of the seriousness with which this administration is approaching this terrible threat to public health.
It is a threat to public health. And Ron, I'm wondering your thoughts on what we started talking a little bit about how people react to hearing the news. And yes, the news media is reporting on it. I'm not sure if you think if you have any thoughts on what we should or shouldn't be doing in terms of that reporting. But the fact is it's happening and Americans are probably very anxious about it. What should people be thinking about in terms of their own anxiety levels if they're paying attention to this and feeling some sort of way, feeling like they need help? And in particular, those people who have either been in close proximity to one of these shootings or know someone who was a victim of one of these shootings in terms of survivors. Like, what mental health services do we need to start putting in place? And is it just a question of mental health, Ron?
Okay, well, first, I do think the news needs to report on it. People need to hear about it. But also, seconding what Adam said earlier, interpersonal violence in this country is not just mass shootings. It's also shootings of domestic partners and physical assaults and the whole gamut. So you're extraordinarily, over your lifetime, likely to have been exposed to violence, either at school or in the household in this country. And that has mental health effects, avoidance, depression, and withdrawal. And to answer your question directly, what can we do? The first thing you have to realize is when there's a problem. So if you're changing the things that used to give you joy, if you're doing things differently, if you're withdrawing, if you're not fulfilling the roles that you need to fulfill during the day, then it's an indication that this violence has negatively affected you. So if somebody witnesses violence, for example, at school or witnesses a mass shooting, and then they stop going out of the house and they stop living their life, that is an indication that you need to get some help, some evidence-based counseling. And I say evidence-based counseling because the treatment is not simply talking about the weather or talking about your childhood. The treatment is focused on exposing yourself to realistically safe reminders of the event. So you might still have to go to the store, you might still have to go to places, but places that are realistically safe.
Like, there's a bigger problem here in that why do we have to live like this, I think is what I'm hearing from a lot of people. I don't know if you, Ron or Adam, either one of you want to weigh in like that, but there's something that we're sort of getting used to the fact that this is happening. Go ahead.
No, we accept it. We've accepted violence as a communication style. We've accepted violence as the way it is. And it doesn't have to be that way. 75% of the population want better background checks and gun control. But I would take it a step further. We have too much violence in the household. We have accepted domestic violence as a way of life. Now, after the 70s, 80s, the O.J. Simpson trial, things like that, we said, no, domestic violence is bad. But in fact, domestic violence during this pandemic has exploded. Elder abuse has increased. All of these things we're accepting. So I think it's got to come from a general putting the foot down and saying we're not going to accept violence as a communication style in school, in the home, and all of these places. Because we are an extremely violent society. If you look at how many people have been physically assaulted by the time they're age 65, it's a tremendous proportion of the population. That's odd. And so when you say, why are so many people having psychological effects of this? Well, because they're normal. And that's the normal response to being beaten up.
I think you're absolutely right, Ron. And Adam, I'm just curious about, I mean, we talked a little bit about what President Biden's executive orders are meant to do. And to be honest, I look at the infrastructure, I look at the culture of violence in the United States that we have. I look at the infrastructure for purchasing guns right now. And I just don't see a clear path to getting past this violence, societal violence, at least not from a legislative perspective, for quite some time. It just feels like we're chipping away at a problem while people are still dying.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, look, nobody is saying that any one law or any one bill pending in Congress is going to solve this problem. We obviously have cultural changes that we need to see before we're able to eliminate this violence that, Ron's absolutely right, pervades our society. But there are important legislative steps. There are important policies that can be adopted. We have policies that we know have been proven to reduce gun violence. And starting with those initial steps, I think, is critically important at this point.
Are there other countries that are getting it right in terms of gun violence?
Well, virtually every other country is getting it right. Even just look north of the border in Canada, where there's actually, compared to most other countries around the world, a very high level of gun ownership, whether it's, you know, rifles and shotguns for hunting or handguns. But there is a much greater regulation of gun possession, of who purchases guns, and the kind of training, the kind of education that needs to be done before they're granted a gun license. So I think we don't have to look far to see some common sense regulation. You know, to drive a car in this country, you need a license, you need registration. We don't have that for guns. And starting to provide training, to provide meaningful oversight and regulation of gun ownership, I think is a critical first step, at least, towards addressing these problems.
Adam Skaggs is Chief Counsel and Policy Director for the Giffords Law Center, and Ron Acherno is the Executive Director of the Trauma and Resilience Center and Professor of Psychiatry at UT Health Houston. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
It's literally becoming a weekly event, and while I haven't become numb to it, it's like, of course there's another mass shooting because nothing is being done about it. No change equals no change. And no change is going to happen until we acknowledge the only difference between the U.S. and other countries who don't have mass shootings is we have too many handguns and a lot of lame reasons for why we should be able to have them. This is Catherine Ryan from New York City.
Leanne from Los Angeles. How has the deluge of gun violence in our country affected my family? Well, my pacifist teens who walked alongside their Black, Brown, and Indigenous brothers and sisters in BLM protest now want guns for their own personal protection. This is not at all how any of us thought it would turn out.
Hello, this is Bennett in Louisville, Kentucky. I'm calling in response to the question about gun violence. Guns are not violent. People are violent. I carry a firearm for violent people. I'm not afraid of inanimate objects. It's just you have to be prepared for whatever may come.
What about my freedom to work, shop, send kids to school, see a movie, or even walk down the street? Guns should be licensed, insured, and policed like cars and drivers. If people want to join a well-regulated militia, they can join the National Guard. Thank you.
Hi, this is Charlie from Portland, Oregon. My take on this is, you know, as much as you don't like to say it, we need to focus less on how these crimes are committed and focus on why these shootings are happening. I think we get mired in this argument over gun control, and both sides have valid arguments, but I think gun control boils down to collective punishment on an entire nation over the acts of few. And yet in that whole argument, the bigger picture of what drives another human being to kill other human beings gets overlooked. And we need to focus on that more than trying to take guns from people. We need to get help for people is what we need to focus on.
Hi, my name is Marigold from what used to be Sleepy San Diego. The gun violence is getting too close. It's got to be stopped. I'm afraid I will get killed when I go outside my door.
This is Lee Konzak in St. Louis, Missouri. It makes me reflect on how different we are compared to other countries in terms of the frequency of mass shootings we have seen the past 20 years. I am a gun owner. I own a shotgun and shoot once in a while for sport, but I am in favor of universal background checks and banning assault weapons for good. They are military weapons, for God's sake, and designed to kill people. The Constitution does not give people the right to own military weapons.
Katie from St. Louis, Missouri. I have several years of experience working with grieving kids who have been affected by gun violence. I would be surrounded with 10 children, elementary age, all who have lost significant person from gun violence, and it's just devastating. And the kids want peace, and they want, you know, everyone to put down the gun. Something needs to give.
I have not grown numb to the recent mass shootings. I want reasonable gun laws enacted. I want background checks to be mandatory for every single weapon sale. And I want longer waiting periods to purchase weapons enacted into law. I just want common sense to prevail. This is Pam, and I'm from Louisville, Kentucky. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jonathan from Louisville, Kentucky. And no, gun violence has not taken an emotional or physical toll on our family. We've come to realize that it's part of American daily life every day now. All we have to do is watch our local news to see how many people are shot and or killed each night. And it's unfortunate, but it has made us become more aware of what people are doing when we are out and about in our surroundings. And I guess it's a good thing to be a little more cautious.
Hi, this is Peter calling from Boynton Beach, Florida. Yeah, I think it's very depressing, all these shootings. I can't believe Congress won't do anything about it. I think we should leave our flags at half-mast permanently. Seems like the state we're in.
This is Jane Stackhouse from Portland, Oregon. The question today was, how has gun violence impacted you? And my response is, not directly, and yet every day.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.